This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Pediatric cancer strikes the smallest and youngest among us. Every day, 42 children are diagnosed. That's more than 15,000 a year. Pediatric cancer is the leading cause of death by disease of children after infancy. Although the cure rate is rising, children with cancer and the doctors who treat them face challenges that are unique to them because fewer children than adults are diagnosed with cancer. Most of the medicines used to treat them are lower dosage versions of drugs developed for use in adults, and that can be a problem. Fortunately, there are people doing research into the causes, treatments, and cures for pediatric cancer, and we'll hear from a few of them today. Dr. Paulette Bryant is a pediatric hematologist-oncologist with Novant Health, Bloom Pediatric Hematology and Oncology, and is the clinic's principal investigator for the Children's Oncology Group and works to expand access to clinical trials for children. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Gilman is director of pediatric blood and marrow transplantation at Carolina's Healthcare Systems Levine Children's Hospital. He, too, is dedicated to improving the success of blood and marrow transplantation through clinical research trials, which have been credited with marked improvement in cure rates of childhood cancer. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Brecca Putnam is community development and ultimate hike manager for Cure Search for Children's Cancer, a nonprofit that funds and supports targeted and innovative children's cancer research. She joins us by phone. Good morning to you. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me turn you on. Good morning to you. Welcome. And Meg McElwain is founder of the Mitchell Bays Turner Pediatric Fund, which was founded in honor of her son Mitchell, or Mitchie, who was diagnosed at 3 months old with a rare form of infant acute lymphocytic leukemia. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning. So the number of children who come down with various forms of pediatric cancer is greater than 15,000 every year in this country alone. It, as I said, it's the largest cause of death after infancy among children. Put that number into context. What is the next leading cause of death in children?
Well, young children, accidents are the first cause of death. And so you have accidents and then cancer. So that gives you an idea of all the cancers. Pediatric cancers probably make up about 1%.
And when you take that number, 15,000 new diagnoses a year, and you compare that to the number of adults who are diagnosed around the country every year, how does that number stack up?
Very, very, very rare and small portion of it. You have 15,000 diagnosed. You may have 40,000 getting treatment. You have 1.6 million adults getting diagnosed a year.
And that's the problem, isn't it?
It is. It's very much the problem because with those numbers, you don't see the impact. You don't consider how many years of life that have been lost. You don't see how we could really help children. And many times funding is based on numbers and not as far as impact of what we can do to help other kids and families.
So we have two specialists who deal with various different kinds of cancer here. We have a bone marrow transplantation specialist, and we have a hematologist, oncologist here. How many different kinds of children's cancer are there? Is it the same number that there would be in adults? Are they the same cancers?
They're actually different cancers. So there are many types, probably just as many in pediatrics. Some of them overlap. Some of the leukemias, for example, are both in children and adults. But a lot of the solid tumors in children are embryonic cancers that aren't seen in adults, and they're related or occurred related to development.
You have an adult, you think of breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, something in that range. And some of the adult cancers are lifestyle cancers, meaning that the adult smoked or worked in a very toxic factory or was overweight, didn't exercise. A child doesn't have that environmental impact. And so a child's cancer is usually a fast-growing cancer because children have dividing cells. And what happens is that there's something wrong with the replication. One of those cells doesn't quite get it right, and that's what causes the cancer.
So is it never environmental? Because it seems to me that children are exposed to things in the womb that perhaps the mother is completely unaware of, or the father for that matter.
It's never, you can never say never, but, you know, like radiation can cause cancers and certain type of toxins, certain genetic conditions where there's a genetic program that goes from mother or father to child that programs the child to have cancer. But those are rare. Most of the time it is something that happens. And that's why we always tell these children and families, there is nothing you could do to prevent this, because it's something that happens just by rapid division.
Is there one cancer in children that is more prevalent, more common than others?
Yes, the leukemias.
Leukemias.
And brain tumors. They're about 50% of what we see.
Okay. The average age of a child diagnosed with cancer, I'm told, is 6. That means it's an average. So there are children younger and there are children older, right up to young adulthood, who are getting certain cancers. Are children of certain ages more prone to get certain cancers than others?
So like acute lymphoblastic leukemia occurs most commonly in preschoolers. Hmm. So again, it's related to development, rapid division, maybe exposure to viruses.
And leukemia is obviously a blood cancer. What exactly is going on with leukemia?
Well, leukemia is a cancer that affects usually the white cells, the cells that normally defend our body, the lymphocytes, mm-hmm. Some of the myeloid cells. And what happens is there's a change that the cell divides, but it doesn't copy the DNA exactly right. And there's a problem that occurs in a set of genes that helps the cell live. So that causes the cells to multiply and multiply and multiply and eventually go places that they shouldn't go.
So that's the most common form of cancer in a young child. Adolescents, I'm told, and young adults are often diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, melanoma, testicular cancer, thyroid cancer, sarcoma. Any others that I've left off the list?
Those are the main players.
And Meg, your son Mitchell was diagnosed with infant acute lymphocytic leukemia at 3 months old. Exactly what is that cancer and how did it present itself in Mitch?
Well, it is a cancer of the white blood cells, and it presented itself in petechiae in his legs, which were bruising. You know, when a child is 3 months old, they're not crawling, they're not walking. I mean, he was not even sitting up yet. And so we first noticed on the front of both of his legs, it looked like someone had taken their fingers and just put prints all down the front. Hmm. And so we took him in to the pediatrician the following day, and thankfully the doctor ran a blood panel, and it showed that his white blood count was very high. He was anemic, you know, various other things, and they sent us directly to the hospital, and that's how our journey began.
That must have been a horrible day.
It was a shocking day. Before my child got cancer, cancer was just a word mm-hmm. to me. I knew that it was a disease. I knew mostly about breast cancer. I knew about Lance Armstrong's organization, Live Strong, but had not been touched so intimately with the disease. And yes, it was definitely shocking.
Did the doctors give you any insight as to why Mitchie might have come down with this?
They did not. Just as Dr. Bryant said, they were very clear to tell us there was nothing we had done wrong, mm-hmm. that there was nothing we could do to prevent it, that it was a genetic problem, and you know, we trusted what they. Everything happened so quickly once he was diagnosed that. I'm fortunate that we had a great team that we trusted.
So his only symptoms were visual, the bruising on his legs, which you could have missed that, I suppose, or you could have ignored it thinking, well, maybe somebody touched him too hard at some point. Had you not caught it then, what would the next symptoms have been? Do you know?
Lethargy. He was spitting up more. He was still taking a bottle, and it was because his liver and his pancreas were enlarged from the leukemia. So I think over the next few days we would have seen, but I'm quite an attentive mother, and yeah. I don't waste time to go
when,
to the doctor.
When did treatments begin? How soon after?
Immediately.
Immediately.
Yes. When we arrived at the hospital, they started a blood transfusion. They told us that the following morning he would go into surgery where they would place what's known as a double lumen Hickman line into the main artery of his heart. The lumens hang out, and that's how he would receive treatment. He got his first spinal. He had a spinal tap that day. They injected intrathecal chemo into the spine, and they gave him a chemotherapy treatment in his lines, and that's how that's one treatment, and it was daily from there on.
Now, a three-month-old is a tiny human being. How do you know what to do for a child that age? I mean, chemotherapy is brutal on the largest of adults. How do you treat a child like that?
Well, most institutions that treat children are part of the Children's Oncology Group, and we've been treating children for many, many, many years, and we realize that little 3-month-olds are not little adults. They have their own way of metabolizing the drug. They often can take higher concentrations per body weight than an adult, and they usually heal better than an adult. Some of the things that we give to little ones, an adult probably wouldn't be able to handle it. And we have learned by being a part of a group, because it's so rare, we have found out by sharing information, treating children the same, and making adjustments throughout the country and the world, how to go about treating a 3-month-old and a 1-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old, even a 17 or 18-year-old.
And Brecca, I haven't forgotten about you as you sit on the phone wherever you are this morning, but you are, Brecca Putnam is the community development and ultimate hike manager for an organization called Cure Search for Children's Cancer. They search or support the search for innovative children's cancer research. This is one of the problems that children face, the fact that there's not enough money going into the system to help find cures specifically designed for children. Since your organization has been involved in this, have you been successful at all in helping find some of these cures or treatment protocols?
Absolutely. So over the past 40 years, the overall cure rate has gone from 10% to 90%, which when you take that at face value is huge progress. But obviously, any young life lost to cancer is one life too many. The other part of the story is when we use these drugs that were primarily developed for adults, what we find is 3 in 5 of our survivors have long-term devastating side effects. So we're talking about things like cognitive impairments or loss of limb, infertility, higher risk of cardiac conditions or secondary cancers. So we've made a lot of progress, but we have a long way to go.
Treating childhood cancer is obviously challenging because it's a small person, it's a small individual, and treatments have not been necessarily designed for them, and you're taking adult medications, adult protocols and treatments and reducing them, and I guess some of that is guesswork, although over time I'm sure you've figured it out, but there aren't enough drugs designed specifically for children, there aren't enough treatments designed specifically for treatment. What is the impact of that? Are kids dying or suffering in the course of these treatments unnecessarily? And I have about 30 seconds here.
I think as oncologists, it frustrates us that drugs have to filter through adults before they can go into pediatric trials, and that delays the benefit for children.
We're going to talk more about that because that is the key problem here. Now, we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's University of Charlotte, where the McCall School of Business offers MBA programs for executives, professionals, and a new online option. Registration for the September 18th session available at queens.edu. And Park Sterling Bank, providing financial solutions for personal and business needs, answers you can bank on. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, details at parksterlingbank.com. The American middle class, the backbone of the economy, is collapsing. That's not news. There are workers, middle managers, small business owners who have fallen victim to rising economic inequality. Their wages have been stagnant for years, unemployment uncertain. Their debt levels have been rising, and they face increasing child care, health care, and education costs. We're going to hear from an expert about why this is happening with some suggestions on what to do about it tomorrow. at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, as the U.S. steps up involvement in Iraq and Syria, questions emerge about Arab support for American action. Who's joining the U.S. fight against ISIS, the extent of their commitment, and the role of Congress in authorizing military force?
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Dr. Paulette Bryant, a pediatric hematologist and oncologist with Novant Health Bloom Pediatric Hematology and Oncology. Dr. Andrew Gilman, director of the Blood, Marrow, and Transplant Transplantation Center at the Carolinas Healthcare Center in Levine Children's Hospital. Boy, how do you fit it on the door? Brecca Putnam is with us by phone. She's Community Development and Ultimate Hike Manager for Cure Search for Children's Cancer. And Meg McElwain, founder of Mitchell Bay's Turner Pediatric Fund for Childhood Cancers. Brecca, you point out that in the last 2 years, only two cancer medications have been developed, only two, specifically for children. What were they?
In the last 20 years.
Oh, 20 years.
Only two.
Well, that's far worse than two.
Yes, that is far worse. And that's really part of the problem, as we've kind of alluded to. You know, we've only had two medications specifically for children developed in the past 20 years. And so what I always compare it to is, you know, you wouldn't give your child a dose of adult Tylenol at just a smaller level. You would go out and buy children's Tylenol. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing to our children. And we're giving them different amounts of adult medications.
Let me turn the question around. If there are only two in the last 20 years that have been developed for children, why? Why those two?
Sure. It's a really complicated process. So when we're talking about, you know, taking an idea all the way through the research pipeline, there's four different phases. So we've got basic translational clinical trials, which folks are probably more familiar with, and then the FDA review and approval process. When we're looking at the probably the most complex phase, the most challenging phase, is translational research. And when medications or drugs or ideas come into the translational phase, the overall rate of success at that level is just 1%. And that's true of pediatric and adult cancer drugs and probably for other diseases as well. But so if we have 5,000 to 10,000 compounds that are being tested, only five of those will end up as phase one studies. So if you think about the body of work that goes into making a drug, it's really quite overwhelming. And unfortunately, with pediatric cancer being more rare than some of the adult cancers, the incentive just isn't necessarily there for scientists and for drug companies to go through and try and push through pediatric drugs when we know, unfortunately, you know, across disease types, a lot of these ideas die before they even reach patients. We call it the research valley of death.
Brecca used the term, she said that we would not give a child an adult dose of Tylenol. We would go out to the store and we would buy children's Tylenol. But in a hospital clinical setting where we have pharmacists and we have doctors who know a little bit about this stuff, it's not like cutting an aspirin in half and giving it to a child. You do have some expertise. So why isn't that expertise sufficient in terms of reducing the dosages for children using adult medicines or adult treatment protocols? Why isn't that enough?
Because we don't know if there'll be specific side effects to a fast-growing child versus an adult who's finished growing.
So it's not just size, it's what's going on in the child's body as it grows.
Correct. Because of the long-term effects, many of our cancers, we've cured them, but some of the side effects are so detrimental that's as equally as impactful as having the cancer.
So when only two drugs have been developed in 20 years, how many drugs and treatment protocols are there being used today in a clinical setting that were designed specifically for children?
Very few. Most have been developed for adults. So keep in mind that there are so many more adults that the drugs can be tested on.
So we can't quantify, but it's a tiny number.
Right.
Okay, it's a tiny number. To talk about the course of treatment for Mitchell, Meg, he's 3-month-old, diagnosed. One day, the next day, he starts treatment.
Well, the course of treatment, over Mitchell's life, he lived 2 years, he took 417 chemotherapy treatments. He received 75 blood transfusions. He spent 184 days in the hospital. And the days that we were not in the hospital, we were making daily visits to the Bloom Clinic at Novant. He was in isolation for 457 days because of neutropenia, because
his immune system was...
His immune system, even when he was not officially neutropenic, we kept him isolated because we did not want to pose the risk of him catching an infection, because that, you know, Mitchell did achieve remission after the first 6 weeks of his treatment. And so we had remission for a year and a half. He still continued to take the drugs, and then he relapsed in active treatment, and 6 weeks later he died of liver and kidney failure.
What was the impact of all those treatments on him and you?
Well, on Mitchell was an amazing, he had amazing strength, and my husband and I often say he was the only one who didn't know he was sick, because we kept his life very as normal as possible. The impact, the level of stress that you feel as a parent, trying to manage, I have an older child, trying to keep his life stable, manage Mitchell's medical needs. We had to learn to administer medication into the lumens that go into his heart at home. We had to set up fluids to run overnight. So as my child grew, and, you know, babies, they begin, they're just laying there cooing, and then they start to move and pull up and crawl. I lost a lot of sleep, concerned that he would pull the lines from his chest. Mm-hmm. The impact is great. You know, I was fortunate that I was able to continue to work because we did have someone who to provide child care for us in the hospital. But most families, the mother quits her job. Sometimes the father loses his job just because he needs to be there during procedures. They don't have money to pay their mortgage. You know, we're talking about a very young population, young parents often, who don't have savings. They don't often have the emotional maturity to deal with what's happening, and families fall apart in the middle of this battle.
You mentioned that he was the only one in the family that didn't know he was sick. And when you read stories of children, and you see this every day, but when you read stories about children with cancer, the children, if they're old enough to talk and old enough to understand, will ask why. It's all they've known is being in the hospital and going in for blood transfusions and going in for chemotherapy treatments and having lines moved all over their body. And they always feel bad because the chemotherapy makes you feel terrible, and they simply ask why, which really tugs at a person's heartstrings because they're children. Given that it tugs at our heartstrings, why are there no more treatments being developed? I mean, researchers and pharmaceutical companies, are they heartless?
Well, I'll say that one motive behind what I want to do by telling Mitchell's story, mm-hmm. I want to pull the curtain back and show people the gruesome side of this disease, the horrific side, because often I think people see a child with cancer as a cute, smiling, bald child in a marketing ad, and that some days that is what it looks like, but other days you have a child who's screaming uncontrollably, who is so far out on steroids that they can't control themselves, they're hallucinating, they're vomiting, their organs are enlarged, and I tracked Mitchell's journey with, of course, my cell phone camera, now that we have this great technology, with the hope that one day I would show the world what he went through to beat the disease. And now I know that I need to show people what he went through so that we can find a cure for the disease.
Is there an audience for that?
I have people's attention. There are people who are paying attention through my blog. I have a strong social media following. I think people sometimes are intrigued because, you know, sensationalism they want to see. But my goal is to target thought leaders, decision makers, elected officials, the people who can really make a difference.
Your child died shortly after his second birthday, Mitchie.
Yes.
Are you surprised what this has done to you, how this has changed you as a person? Because obviously you are out there fighting.
I don't know that I'm surprised. It has definitely changed me. I have a great deal of pain in my heart, and just, you know, the pain from grief sometimes is overwhelming. I have anger, but I have chosen to channel that to help other people to find a way to bring more awareness to this problem and this need for more funding.
Cancer researchers report feeling held back in their efforts to find cures and to develop treatments and drugs because there is not enough funding for this. 96% of grants, I read, do not get funded. And that lack of funding is not only stymieing research efforts, it's driving researchers out of the field. As an example, about $122 million was spent in 2007 on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, just one form of childhood cancer, while breast cancer received $631 million. And breast cancer, despite what you might know, what you might think, is not the leading cause of death among women. And since 2010, the budget has continued to decrease. Why such a wide discrepancy between breast cancer and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which affects a lot of people?
Well, the bulk of the funding comes from the National Cancer Institute in the NIH, and they looked at the numbers and said, well, 4% is part of your budget, and there's been a whole cut to the National Cancer Institute with the sequester of government about 4 or 5 years ago and continued cuts in government funding. So you're just dividing up a smaller piece of the pie. And with just using numbers, I think you miss the impact of how you could help many of these patients because funding is limited. Because funding is mostly for the adult cancers, pharmacies and pharmaceutical companies are actually going where the money is.
Well, I was going to ask you how much of this is politics because kids don't vote and can't vote, and how much of it is due to the fact that pharmaceutical companies don't see the kind of payoff in developing drugs and protocols for children that they would realize if they developed adult procedures and drugs.
I mean, an example of that is an antibody against neuroblastoma, a pediatric type of cancer that has been developed over 15 years, and it's coming to fruition, and it's being marketed by a company with an interest in therapy of rare diseases. So it will never be a large moneymaker for a drug company. But fortunately, there's a drug company that has a focus on benefiting children with rare diseases.
And this is why money has to come from outside sources. This is why the government is involved. And this is why, because the government has cut back considerably on the money that they funnel into medical research, a lot of this money, most of this money, is coming from philanthropic organizations, correct?
Oh, yes. And we have some organizations that just give to children's cancer. There are many that are for adult cancers, but you've got St. Baldrick's, and you've got Cure Search, and you've got, you know, Cookies for Cancer that are looking just for children's cancer. And I think if there's anyone out there who hears us and wants to help, they have to be careful to make sure they direct their dollars so that it goes to children, mm-hmm. not just to a big fund.
Breca, she just mentioned CureSearch. That's your organization. And your organization says that it accelerates the cure for children at greatest risk of losing their battle with cancer by posing essential challenges to scientists and inviting teams to overcome them with novel research approaches. Talk about that. Is this all accomplished through funding, or is it accomplished through other ways as well?
Sure. So the bulk of what we do is funding children's cancer research, and we fund at all levels. So, you know, both of the physicians that you have there with you receive funding at their institutions for clinical trials. And we know that more children are on clinical trials than adults. Over 60% of kids are on clinical trials, whereas adults aren't on it nearly as much. And part of the reason why we do that is because we know that these great institutions can provide high quality care, but part of it is also keeping the child closer to home. So a child diagnosed in Charlotte is treated by physicians at the excellent institutions in Charlotte, and they can stay closer to home. We know there's the psychosocial benefits associated of having a support system nearby. And I think, you know, that's why funding these organizations that support a variety of institutions collaborating is so important. And we know that no one institution has enough cases of any type of childhood cancer to run the studies that an institution that treats breast cancer may have. And so that's why looking to these organizations like us that fund specifically pediatric cancer research and not just general cancers is the answer to this problem, because the dollars aren't going to come in from the government, unfortunately, at least not within our current system.
In the next segment, I want to talk about clinical trials, but we have people from two different hospital systems sitting at the table, which is unusual. We have Novant and we have Carolina's healthcare system, and you're in competition with each other. You are. I mean, I see the commercials on television. Are there different protocols being conducted at these two hospital systems for children with cancer, or is there overlapping areas of expertise in clinical trials?
First, I just want to say the hospital systems are in competition at this level of hematology oncology for children. We're actually collaborators.
Okay.
So we work together.
Yes.
No?
And it's
in a very collegial manner.
Okay.
It really is a blessing. There is some overlap because many of the children's oncology group protocols are at both institutions. Novant doesn't have a bone marrow transplant unit, and so we rely heavily on Dr. Gilman's group to help keep our kids in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
There are phase one studies, and those are studies where they're just trying to see how safe the drug is. And some of those studies are being done at Levine. And then we have more clinical trials and supportive studies that we have on our own, trying to see if things will make a difference for the family and treatment and taking their medicines and all of those things. So I think on a human level, we're in this to get rid of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hospital systems are hospital systems, but we're pretty much on the same team.
Dr. Gilman?
I agree with that completely.
Okay.
I think we both offer excellent service for children with cancer.
Okay. CureSearch says that they provide accelerated funding to research that confronts the most challenging barriers facing the field of children's cancer research. What are those barriers, Brekka?
Absolutely. So what we did was we had our scientific review board come up with some of the biggest challenges that are out there. And so one of the challenges that we came up with is, you know, why does cancer metastasize in some people and not in others? So if you have two children that have the same diagnosis, same age, same weight, why does it stay in one place in one child, and why does it move throughout the body in another child? And so that was one of the biggest barriers that we've identified, and that's why we funneled $1.73 million into addressing this problem. So we put out a call for proposals, and we had teams of researchers from across the country put out their best ideas, and we've selected those that we think will help meet those challenges. We also have drug resistance, so drugs that are just not working as well as we think they should or even as well as they used to. Cancer is smart and cancer is tricky, and so how do we figure out why drugs aren't always working or why they're working in some cases and not in others?
Let me stop you there, Brekka, because we have to take a break. Brekka Putnam is with CureSearch for Children's Cancer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a woman's specialty retailer, providing distinctive clothing, sportswear, and accessories for women from European and American designers chosen for quality, style, and functionality. Located in Phillips Place, details at trcstyle.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, a 2012 Tony Awards musical, Once, an original Broadway experience about the power of music to connect all of us. September 23rd, Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Well, as the U.S. steps up involvement in Iraq and Syria, questions emerge about Arab support for American action. Who's joining the U.S. fight against ISIS, the extent of their commitment, and the role of Congress in authorizing military force? That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Join ours now by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org.
An extraordinary group of WFAE listeners is making a big difference. Over 2,500 sustaining members provide steady, ongoing support that keeps WFAE strong and independent. ensuring every member of our community has access to the highest quality public radio station available. Thank you, sustainers. You make WFAE happen. Learn more online about the power of sustaining membership at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about children's cancer and the challenges that doctors, children, and parents face, given the fact that not enough money has gone into research over the years on pediatric cancer, and the result is not enough treatments or protocols specifically designed for children, and the result of that is probably a greater failure rate in treating children, unnecessary pain in treating children, unnecessary side effects in treating children. It's a nightmare. Dr. Paulette Bryant is a pediatric hematologist and oncologist with Novant Health, Bloom Pediatric Hematology Oncology. Dr. Andrew Gilman is director of pediatric blood and marrow transplantation at Carolina's Healthcare Systems Levine's Children's Hospital. Brecca Putnam joins us by phone. She is the Community Development and Ultimate Hike Manager. They do hikes for cancer at Cure Search for Children's Cancer. And Meg McElwain is the founder of Mitchell Bay's Turner Pediatric Fund. She lost her son, Mitchell, just shortly after his second birthday to leukemia. How many clinical trials are currently being conducted for children's cancer in the Charlotte area? Do we have a number on that?
We have about 55 open at Novant.
And why are clinical trials, are they as important as just normal treatments, or are they, how would you classify the importance of these trials?
I think they serve two purposes. So I think Becca talked about that earlier, that there are phase three trials where we are having a good deal of success usually in treating a particular cancer. And then we are trying to improve upon that and either have more success or decrease side effects.
I mean, I'm sorry.
I was going to say those trials are important. The other trials are earlier phase trials, like phase one or phase two trials, where we're not having success in treating a certain type of cancer. And there we're trying to develop new treatments.
And obviously you're trying to discover things here, but trial is just that. It is a trial, and there's error in a trial. So is it a good thing for children to be to participate in clinical trials, because they may not succeed, number one, and I would assume that in clinical trials you're using placebos.
No.
No, you're not?
Well, in a phase three, mm-hmm. When the drug gets to phase three, it's been tested, we know it works well with it, and we usually have a backbone of our standard, what worked well 5 years ago, and then this new drug is added to the newer protocol. So you're either going to get the standard treatment, or you're going to get a drug that you would not have been able to get unless you were on a children's oncology group protocol. And because it's being conducted all over the country, if it works, then you would have gotten the best treatment, and then that will become the standard for the next therapy. The other thing is that everyone does it exactly the same. So if you go to Harvard, to Children's Hospital, Philadelphia, Levine, Novant, you're going to get the same exact treatment. It's almost quality control. Mm-hmm. Your doctors have access to some of the best experts in the world on that particular type of cancer. That's all they do is write this protocol and look at patients who have this particular type of cancer. So if your child has cancer, you want to be on a study, because that's going to give you access to a drug you may not have had.
So how are children chosen? Because not everybody gets to be in a study. So how do you choose them?
Well, each study has eligibility criteria as far as the age of the patient, what the patient has, if they have any other comorbidities that would make it difficult for them to be on the study. For instance,
what does that mean, comorbidities?
Well, let's say they have diabetes, okay, and prednisone makes their diabetes worse. They probably wouldn't be a good person to be on that particular study. And let's say they have an allergy to a particular protein, then it wouldn't be a good idea for them to be on that study. And the problem with funding is that when I was a baby hematologist, there were tons of studies available in every different disease. But because the funding is so limited, there's only a few studies open per disease, and some disease groups are certain types of cancers, there are no studies open. So you will get the standard treatment for that disease. The other problem is we are getting better in treatments. So let's say Hodgkin's disease, we're curing most patients. But some of those patients have infertility. Some of those patients have other issues that affect their life. And so we can't test to see if we can cut down on the chemo to make their life better because there's no funding to continue with these type of studies.
Bloom, as you mentioned, Bloom Pediatric Hematology and Oncology is part of the National Children's Oncology Group. That gives you access to the same treatments across the country and a phalanx of expert doctors who only concentrate on particular cancers. Is the same true at Levine Children's Hospital?
Yes, we're part of the Children's Oncology Group.
So everybody has the same... chance to
participate, for sure. Can I just
sure,
I just wanted
please.
To address that question you asked about whether or not a child should be on a clinical trial.
Please do.
It's actually been shown that patients that are treated on clinical trials have a superior outcome to those who are not on a clinical trial. So there's a strong rationale.
Was Mitchell
to do that.
On a clinical trial?
Yes, he took a study drug called Lastartinib, and the way that they qualified him was by looking at his genetic makeup, and he had a certain gene that caused him to be part of the study. And one thing I'll say from a parent's perspective, when you have a child who is diagnosed into this very rare group of people, you become like a family. And so when you have the opportunity to be part of a research study, at least from my husband and my perspective, we felt that it was important not only to give Mitchell the leading edge on whatever new drug might be there, but it also helps the greater good.
According to the National Cancer Institute, many studies have shown that exposure to ionizing radiation, and I think you talked about this just a minute ago, Dr. Bryant, can damage your DNA, which can lead to the development of childhood leukemia and possibly other cancers as well. So where does this radiation come from? Does it come from the atmosphere? Does it come from the mother getting an X-ray while the child's still in utero?
Most of those studies were done on people who are children who received radiation therapy for a brain tumor or for leukemia.
So does that make doctors more reluctant to use radiation therapy on a child?
Well, if you need it for survival, you have to have it. But it's we're finding out that radiation exposures increase your risk. For instance, if you have lots of CT scans or fluoroscopy scans, that can increase your risk for having cancer. And part of the deal is we need to find out what we can use to cause less side effects and get that cure.
I know you're professionals and you're scientists and you're doctors, but you're dealing with children here. This is like the supreme balancing act of what do you do to make this child well without hurting them too much, but everything you do hurts them in some way, physically or not even in terms of pain. It could cause damage later on in life. It's a balancing act. How do you do it?
It definitely is a balancing act. We use approaches that have been demonstrated in the past to provide a chance of cure for children. And then we try to do everything we can and implement all new developments to try to minimize long-term side effects to balance it.
15, 20 years ago, we weren't having this discussion because even in the 60s, if you had a childhood cancer, you had very little chance of life. So I feel it's showing that we're going in the right direction. If we're trying to balance side effects with cure, that means we've come a long way from your child has cancer, there's nothing more we can do, to your child has cancer, we're going to cure them and we're going to try to minimize what comes after that might be difficult.
When a child is diagnosed with cancer and when they are going through treatments, the entire family, as Meg mentioned, is affected by this over time. And in the short term, certainly, but then over time, it probably becomes even worse, particularly as the treatments go on and on and on. Are treatment facilities in Charlotte set up to aid the families who are enduring this?
Yes, there are child life professionals in both children's hospitals. And one of the things that the child life team does is help us understand, help the parents, help the child understand what's happening to them through education that is at a level that a small child or a parent can understand. I know that Novant Bloom Pediatric, they have support groups for the teenagers who are going through the program where they actually do outings. So, yes, there are support.
Meg's experience is with Levant, so I want to bring in Levine Children's Hospital, too, and give you a chance to talk about what's there for parents.
Sure. We have support groups as well. Both hospitals have social services to help families. As Meg was saying, there are a lot of burdens on families, both financial and emotional, and both hospitals have professionals that help deal with those challenges as well.
You know, let's talk a little bit more about that. This is all money. All of this is money. There's not enough money for research, which has held back the progress of children's cancer cure rates. And then we have the problem of people being bankrupted by the medical treatment that their kids have to have to survive. And then we have the problem of people losing their jobs because they have to be able to take their child at a moment's notice for treatments and stay for hours, sometimes days on end. What support is available for those situations? When you have, as you said, Meg, young families who don't have a lot of financial resources because they're just starting out in life, and suddenly this hits them.
Well, that's where funds like Mitchell's Fund come into play. Through the social services, through the child life professionals at the hospital, they will identify a family and who might need help with mortgage payments for the next few months. We paid once for a single mother to pay off the last few car payments so that she could relieve that burden. So there are several funds through each foundation that help with the social needs. And then when a family is diagnosed, we were given a packet from the social worker at the hospital that talked to us about a specific type of bank account that we could set up where we would not be taxed on the money, where people can give to that fund. We could use it for medical needs. And, you know, as long as it was associated
so
for the child.
It's like a health savings account in a way.
Yes.
The survival rates for some childhood cancer rates have improved in recent years while others remain low. Do we understand why that is?
Well, the leukemias, we've been able to look at the genes and figure out what the genetic problem is and adjust our therapy. In fact, we had a young man who had a special antigen on his leukemia cells, and he participated in a trial where we took the white cells out and trained them to go against this antigen, and he was able to go back in remission for another 8 months. And I believe that will be the future. But other tumors, like brain tumors that occur in a special part of your brain where you breathe and you move that part of the brain, you can't biopsy it.
Right.
And it's
you
hard.
You can't study it.
You can't study it, and it's hard to keep that tumor from growing. And we've got a lot of work to do.
The other bad news here is that the incidence of childhood cancers has been on the rise in recent decades. Again, you know, a lot of things have been on the rise with children. Asthma, peanut allergies, it goes on and on. Do we understand what's going on here? Is it environmental, perhaps? Is it in the food that these children are being fed?
I'm not sure that it's in the food, but I think environmental causes probably play a role.
Like what? Do we have any idea?
I mean, there are certainly lots of toxins in the air and water. I think there was just recent mention of toxins in the water in Ohio.
But it seems to me that the air and water right now is much better than it was in the 1950s and 1960s when we didn't know a lot of things and we didn't seem to care. I mean, the Ohio River used to catch fire all the time. So it seems to me that things are better today. So why are these environmental factors harming children more or more often?
It may be, again, our lives have changed back then where before we grow things from the farm. We were not in big city. We didn't have a lot of cars. We didn't have a lot of things.
I have 2 minutes left here, and this is an important point that I want to make sure we bring out. Children and adolescents who are treated for cancer need regular follow-up care for the rest of their lives. Now, some of these conditions have long-lasting side effects, and things might happen later on in life as a result of this that you couldn't even have anticipated. Prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, could these people have gotten health insurance, Brekka, or would they have been on their own? Because it would have been a pre-existing condition.
Sure. Case by case, it varies. We know that certainly aspects of the Affordable Care Act has made it easier as these children grow up. You know, one of the things that you used to have to do in order to remain on your parents' insurance was to carry a full course load in college. And we know that because of some of the side effects, some of these children who are now grown up are not able to carry a full course load because of their follow-up treatment, because of, you know, cognitive impairments, whatnot. And now with the Affordable Care Act, it's more likely that they'll be able to remain on their parents' insurance for longer. And then as they come off of their parents' insurance, you know, that pre-existing condition is not as big of a barrier as it used to be. So hopefully they can continue to receive that very critical follow-up.
Is there anything in the pipeline in the 30 seconds that I have left that holds great promise for these kids?
There are tremendous things in the pipeline. I think there's an explosion of therapies in the last 5 years. So a lot of them are targeted at using the immune system to attack the cancer.
Mm. And do you have hope for those coming online shortly?
Sure. Some of them are actually in clinical trials right now.
Dr. Andrew Gilman is Director of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Carolina's Healthcare Systems Levine's Children's Hospital. Dr. Paulette Bryant is a pediatric hematologist-oncologist with Novant Health, Bloom Pediatric Hematology and Oncology. Brekka Putnam is Community and Development Ultimate Hike Manager for Cure Search for Children's Cancer. And Meg McElwain is the founder of the Mitchell Bayes Turner Pediatric Fund. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte.